3 years after their comics debut, Clamp had their first animation hit the shelves. It's always fun to see your favorite characters come to life with color and voices, but how does this two-episode offering hold up today?
We are Lucy and Robin, and we'll be your guides through Clamp's Wonderland. So, Robin, we've had a week to recover from reading all of Rig Veda in, a couple days. How are you feeling?
I'm not sure I've completely recovered.
Same.
But watching the OAV today, which we watched it half an hour ago.
Yeah.
I don't know whether it's a palate cleanser or whether I'm more confused.
Yeah. I will say that I've already gotten two people to read Rig Veda, and that episode isn't even out yet, so I feel like we're winning so far.
That's good. We're doing a good job of that. I'm happy to think we're doing a good job of that. But wow.
Yeah, so that OVA we just watched.
It very much feels like 1991.
Mm-hmm. So some background on this, if you'll remember from last week, Rig Veda began in 1989. I think the first volume was released in 1990. And the OVA that we're going to talk about today came out as two episodes in 1991 and 1992.
Yeah, we don't have a ton of specs on this, but the production is really different on the two episodes. They don't seem to have been made with the same exact staff. Down to, we think the voice actors are different, but we cannot find very clear information on that.
Yeah, most of the places we found listed the same list of voice actors for both, which is what's on the official US DVD that we bought. But yeah. I'm pretty sure that that's inaccurate, and we just couldn't verify that. So if anybody knows, please send us your links.
Yeah, because Yuo's voice is definitely Kape Yamaguchi in the second episode. I super recognize that voice. He has a very recognizable voice. He's like everybody. But I don't think that's who was voicing him in the first episode. I feel like I would have noticed.
Did we cross-reference that?
We tried, but we really couldn't find anything. So that's a little weird. But the artwork looks different. The production values are different. The music is exactly the same. And, thank goodness, because it would have been a huge... it would have been too much whiplash, I think.
Yeah, it was weird enough because the art style changed pretty significant. At least the music... We were listening to the original Japanese. At least the music stayed the same, which helped it at least have some cohesion.
Yeah, it was definitely an interesting experience to watch.
Before we get a little bit more into it, though, Robin, what's an OVA?
Okay, so OVA, or OAV, it's either original video animation or original animation video. It kind of doesn't matter which one you're talking about. They technically might be different just depending on how they're being paid for, but I'm not sure that I've ever tracked down that information.
Yeah, I feel like they got marketed pretty similarly here, if they were called that at all.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Well,
some did, but
yeah. It would be only to distinguish whether it's the TV series or these little direct-to-video miniseries. So I guess that's, the good explanation is these are direct-to-video animations. Sort of like the Disney sequels.
Yeah, it's from the 90s, that era.
Talking about Disney sequels in, the 90s is sort of a useful frame of reference for these, where in the 80s, when VHS players became something that people could just have in their homes, and they became sort of a ubiquitous thing you would have in your home, the home video market was enormous, and people needed things to sell people. There was just such a huge market, and you could sell people anything. So instead of paying for an entire animated TV series, which is an incredible amount of human labor, let alone money, there aren't that many animation studios with people who have that skill set. There aren't that many TV channels and time slots to run shows on. And this is especially pre-streaming and pre-internet. I mean, where were you going to have little mini episodes, or where were you going to have TV pilots or just experimental things? The answer was you would rent them at video rental stores, or you would buy them directly on video, often kind of mail order. Sometimes they could be special giveaways with magazines. There was all kinds of ways that these would be distributed. Sometimes it was very fan direct market, where they knew there were people who wanted this material. And yeah, it was only going to be people who had already read the manga, but that was a lot of people. And if you were selling a tape for, $20 to $40 a piece, even though it has like an hour maybe of material on it, you could get away with that at the time. That's nuts. I hate that. Like, that's such a tiny amount of thing you're paying for. But if you think about that as being more directly money given to the people making it, as opposed to everything going through like three or four levels of different studios, like, you can imagine that being maybe a better deal for some of the animation studios and some of the creators. I have a feeling that that was not always the case, though.
Suspect you may be right.
Yeah, sometimes these would be paid for by the publisher. Sometimes they would be paid for by the creators directly, which is rare, but I'm pretty sure that I've read about that happening.
Yeah, I have too. I don't know a specific example, but yeah.
But sometimes they would be paid for by investors who just wanted a piece of that delicious home video pie.
Yum.
Yeah, and so, like, a camera company put up money for the original Tenchi Muyo, maybe?
That's so weird! Because that's one of those that comes to me as an example of the difference, where there's the Tenchi Muyo OVA, which was pretty long for that.
Yeah.
And then Tenchi Universe, which was the TV show, and I think they're all called No Need for Tenchi in Japanese.
Yeah.
This is sort of all-American bullshit, but that's the best example I can think of.
Well, I can think of a whole lot of interesting examples where an OAV was sort of a pilot for a show that was produced later, and often I would say that a lot of shoujo manga would get an OAV and maybe never a bigger adaptation. Maybe sometimes even more like a music video rather than a couple episodes or a one-shot. Sometimes an OAV would be original scripts written specifically for that format. Sometimes an OAV would be kind of somebody trying to adapt like a movie-length version of the whole thing, which is terrible. And sometimes it will be sort of like trying to just make two episodes of a series that doesn't exist.
Yeah, I remember seeing a lot of them when I was really into anime and renting it, where it was just like two episodes of something that never came here otherwise, and I could never find more of it, and it was very confusing.
Sometimes there was no more of it because OAVs were very cheap to license in the late 80s and early 90s in America, because a lot of the time there were fewer people that you would have to pay licensing fees to, but they also were kind of orphaned by that point. Like, some of these, like, they had sold the copies they were going to sell. Selling them to foreign markets was something they'd never intended to do, or they really had intended to do it. In either case, they were ready for that. They wanted, you know, these would be licenses that, like, U.S. Manga Corps and other publishers who at this point, do they even exist? Some of these people don't exist.
I don't know, yeah. I feel like we don't get as many OVAs anymore at all, though.
I'm not so certain that these are how any of this is made anymore, because this had so much to do with the VHS market. These days, you would release web series, which is absolutely a thing anime does.
That makes sense, yeah.
Yeah. You get all kinds of, like, experimental little videos and, like, kind of pilots and things. I can think of a few examples of something that had basically a pilot and then a TV series, and two examples where the OAV, because it was direct-to-video, could get away with things the series never could. I know that there is a storied tradition of people who were really big BL fans having strong feelings about Gravitation, having a really different OAV from the series, where the series kind of leaves everything in a yearning kind of way, and the OAV was more, like, overtly sexual. I actually have never seen either of those, so this is what I understand. But Magic Users Club is another one that, like,
you broke my brain, Robin. I forgot that still existed.
I'm so sorry to remind you.
No, I loved it. God.
Well, like, I had never seen it, and we recently, it was all in Crunchyroll, so we were watching a piece of it, and a friend was like, only watch the OAV. Because in that case, well, the OAV is definitely, like, on the exact edge of hentai, the OAV at least has, like, better characterizations or something.
Yeah, that seems to, like, granted, I forgot the show existed until, like, a minute ago, but that seems to be my memory of it, was that the OAV had, like, much stronger development and was much more entertaining to me, whereas the TV series felt a little flat.
Yeah, and that's another interesting point, where if you were putting a relatively large budget into two episodes, or three episodes, or four episodes, if you're putting a relatively large budget into that, you can kind of have really quick, snappy pacing. Mm-hmm. Sometimes the art can match the original art more closely because they could put a lot more, like, time and energy into that. When it comes to a TV series, often the production is moving really quickly and introducing new characters and having all these designs. Like, sometimes the budget just isn't really there for that anymore.
Mm-hmm. Like, you'll see where opening themes are gorgeous and then the TV animation for, like, the rest of the show is kind of...
Yeah, I think that some of this is stuff that... For listeners who are a lot younger and a lot newer to this material, this might sound really alien because you may not have grown up in a time where that was the case. Mm-hmm. But oh my goodness, up until maybe 5 years ago, the difference between the TV animation and the opening would be often vast. Mm-hmm. Recently, if they're different, it may be because they're actually handled in a more like designy way.
Yeah, like that's like an artistic decision that someone made, not just like a result of budgets.
Yeah, like there is budget in animation right now in Japan. There kind of wasn't for a lot of the 90s because the bubble burst in the late in about 1990-1991, and a lot of things that might have had a long, luxurious, beautiful OVA or a series didn't get one. Mm-hmm. And I am not certain whether Rig Veda would have gotten a series had the economy been better.
Yeah, I don't know.
I think that the rest of our discussion will help lead you to the conclusions we might come to in that, but definitely it didn't. Like, this was, whether this was done as a pilot or not, it definitely did not become a series. This is all we have are these two really disparate episodes. So I was mentioning that OAVs can sometimes get away with things that a TV animation can't, because TV stations have, like, standards and practices that you have to abide by, and they may be squeamish about stuff, mm-hmm. but the home video market has fewer, like, just laws about what you can produce. I said that, but there's something kind of interesting about the Rig Veda OAV, where it feels incredibly tame.
Yeah, it felt less gory and less gay. Which was...
What else is there in Rig Veda if you remove...
Exactly! I mean, not that there wasn't... I mean, there were definitely lots of, you know, people getting chopped up and stuff in battle scenes, but it didn't ever go to, like, kind of the almost artistically gory depths that the manga does at some points.
Yeah, it really glossed over a lot of things, and it had a few scenes with battles and a few scenes where people are just stabbing each other plotfully, but it really did downplay the blood a lot.
Yeah, I guess we should do a quick summary, which we will do much quicker than the actual summary of Rig Veda that we did, and we're sorry, guys.
It's very hard to summarize something that took people 7 years to make and also was, like, tightly plotted and twisty-turvy and literally pulls a fast one on you at the end. It's kind of hard.
But this is much easier. So there are two episodes, as we've mentioned. The first episode takes a plot line that's kind of... I want to say, like, the second or third volume of the manga, if even that. And it's about... They go back to visit the Yasha tribe area, as they do a few times. And they encounter this monster that supposedly the Yasha clan had never been able to defeat. In the manga, we learn because it existed in this castle that would come and go kind of Brigadoon style, where it would just be there sometimes and then not other times. And this, that never really comes up, but they go there, they encounter, Yasha gets captured, and they encounter this monster that's kind of taken on the form of this young girl who hid there during, I think, the big, like, Taishaku Ten rebellion 300 years ago.
Definitely during that, yeah. She's Princess Aizen-myo.
Yeah.
I don't remember whose daughter she was. Maybe one of the dead generals. I don't remember. It doesn't really matter.
I don't remember the specifics.
It's nice and tragic and terrible because she's very young.
Yeah, she's very young. She's very kind of innocent and pretty and kind of afraid. She's probably about I think we see flashbacks. She's like the same age as like Karura and a bunch of our other like main characters, like the other six stars. I think she's vaguely in their age demographic. I think you see shots of her hanging out with, like, Kandapa.
Yeah. But she never got to grow up because she hides in this castle and gets eaten by the terrible ice monster, ice demon. I think they use Mazoku.
Yeah, I think throughout the series they use Mazoku, which we didn't get to before, but now we've heard spoken, and I looked up, I think, some of my books had it as Mazoku.
Yeah, which is, it's useful to know, like, what words they're using for different kinds of monsters, because it helps keep them straight. Mm-hmm. But also can tell you a little bit about how they view them. Are they creatures, or are they people? And I think that my version definitely just called everything a demon.
Yeah, my version definitely used monster a lot, so that's interesting. Because to me, Mazoku is more of, like, a demonic monster than just, like, a dinosaur or something.
Yeah, when you say monster, I don't know whether you mean, like, monster hunter, dinosaurs, mm-hmm. or whether you mean a person who is monstrous. Like, it could be a person with, like, an extra hand. It really could be anything. Yeah. So it's, but anyway, she's sort of eaten by this terrible thing, and then it takes on her form. Mm-hmm. So she looks like a sweet little girl with really ridiculous hair and, like, a huge headdress, and I really don't love her design, but that is...
I kind of like her design.
Yeah, I'm sorry. That's just me editorializing, as I just, like, oh, there's just too much stuff. It's too much stuff. I don't want to draw it.
It could be better. So she captures Yasha and everybody else, but most emotionally, Ashida have to get in and save him and get out, and... All while this is going on is they're being chased by the armies of Taishakuten's men who are trying to kill them. So there are big battles outside the castle, and trying to get into the castle is difficult because of this. And
it's a moment where we get some of Ashida's sword, the Shurato, being revealed to us. But it's also a moment where Kujaku shows up and is helpful. And it's one of the first times that we get the feeling that we can trust him from his actions. But why is he helping us? Like, it's a really good moment for him as well.
Yeah, you get a lot of his character development, I think, both in the manga and in this. Although we had feelings about how he did not look right, but that's a separate...
Yeah, his design was really weird.
Yeah, everyone's was a little off, but he, like, noticeably looked like a different character. Like, his hair was, like, smaller, like, shorter, I guess, and his body was bigger, and his face was a little more masculine than it normally is.
He had a little bit more of a real person chin and not a sharp, pointy chin, but his face was just a lot longer.
Yeah.
And it's weird how much that affected how I viewed the character, because it just didn't feel like the same person.
Mm-hmm. Although it did remind me of, in those, like, early first two volumes of Rigveda, there was more, like, people would go off model a little bit more. Like,
it's true.
And him especially, I remember us, like, texting each other being like, what has happened to Kujaku's shoulders? And this kind of reminded me of that.
A little bit. So we get that storyline. I mean, like, this character sort of captures Yasha, and in the comic, there's very much this, like, there's a bait and switch kind of thing where the monster is all like, oh, Yasha, you're so strong, I've been waiting for you. And there's sort of, like, a romantic tinge to it. And then there's a, like, no, I've been waiting to eat you.
Mm-hmm.
Like, my big strong man for dinner.
Yeah.
Because she wants to wear his form, because if she can wear his form, the strongest guy ever in that world, then she can kind of just keep going. Like, yeah. she can be stronger, and she could perhaps, like, do some real damage.
And I think she's kind of got the munchies, too, because she's, like, been there since she ate this girl 300 years ago or whatever, and no one has found this castle since then.
He is a big hunk of man meat, also.
Yeah, he would be a good meal.
Yeah, but the OAV went a very different direction with that.
Yeah, it kind of changed. It definitely, maybe it just held off on the bait and switch longer, but it gave her all these, like, sympathetic shots that were mostly the same shot over and over again. Her talking about how lonely she was and how she didn't remember who she was, and it kind of felt like it was making you think that if it was a monster, it didn't realize that anymore. And I don't remember that from the comic anyway.
No, it wasn't really there. This was much more of a sympathetic portrayal and much more of a romantic thing.
Mm-hmm. And much more like trying to be kind of a foil for Ashida, where I really don't think it was in the comic at all. But it was playing more because you've got, since they're at the former Yasha tribe's, like, area, there's a lot of, like, guilt and sadness for Yasha and Ashida with everything that went down there, and especially Ashida and loneliness comes up a lot, and so there was a lot of parallels in the OAV with this chick and her loneliness, and Ashida and their loneliness. And
yeah, which is actually really cool, and didn't come up quite the same way in the manga. So we should maybe point out that Nanase Okawa did write the script for this.
Yeah.
So I like to think that this was her chance to revisit that story and do it slightly differently in order to make them a foil. Like, I think that was perhaps, like, a very purposeful decision that wasn't just made to make it fit in the time limit, but was actually meant for her to get to explore that story differently.
Yeah, and I think it was a good one to pick, because there aren't a lot of, like episodic chunks you could kind of pull out of the story that would make a whole lot of sense. And this one does like bring up a lot of the characters' baggage and make them kind of deal with it and give them excuses to talk about it. So I think it worked as a good, like, remember what happened here last time, and remember how we're dealing with all of these emotions? Oh, and remember how your sword is magic? Like, it gave a lot of, like, excuses to introduce stuff without feeling, I think, too forced.
Yeah, and other than that, it mostly kind of, like, moved elements of the story around and really reduced Soma's role.
Yeah, that was strange. And we couldn't quite pinpoint exactly when this came out as far as where in the manga was being released, but I'm pretty sure that Karuda hadn't joined them yet. Like, we knew her and her plotline was progressing, but in the manga I don't think she was officially part of the crew yet. And this kind of gave a good way of introducing her and having her already in, kind of taking the part of Soma at that point in the manga story, which is kind of like a background character. Like, support Tsuyasha and Asha kind of going through this stuff.
Yeah.
And gave a lot of her lines, like, literally her lines to Karuda.
She's our beautiful exposition ninja.
Yes. And in this, she was still there, but she joined a little later, like, partway through the episode, after having Kandapa just kind of send her to check on them and convey them information about the coming invasion, or the trap, I guess, that was being laid for them.
Yeah.
Which was a little weird, but I think worked. Like, it's not how it happened in the manga, but I think it was a good excuse rather than having to try and deal with Karuda's whole plot line.
Yeah, which if you were going to do would take, and it would be an entire episode on its own, and it would be incredibly sad.
Yeah.
And I really, really understand them not wanting to do that episode because it's not focusing on any of the main characters.
Yeah.
And it's really tragic and difficult because it involves a child dying.
Yeah, and by the time it would end and you would get her to the rest of the characters, yeah, you wouldn't have any context for everything else that was going on, really.
And you already don't have a lot of context.
Yeah.
Like, these OAVs do not stand on their own. And for anyone, which was us as kids, who watched them without any idea what's going on, it would just be like this tantalizing glimpse into a story that isn't even really the story the manga tells.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is, I think a lot of OAV do that, and there's something about people who came into anime and manga in our era. We're not even the oldest of old-timers for this. We're 20 years younger than the people who were kind of the old school.
Yeah.
Even then, a lot of this material would be so hard to get a hold of and so difficult to find information on that there was such a, like, investment of your time and energy into figuring out how these things were related. And especially if you didn't have family in Japan and didn't speak Japanese, it would be really hard to find any of that information whatsoever, other than message boards, if you were lucky to find people who actually knew what they were talking about. And a lot of people didn't know what they were talking about, did a lot of flexing. There was a lot of weirdness in that community at that time of just, you know, and people would have their own perspective on some of these works and would be very insular and make it really difficult to communicate about it sometimes.
Yeah. Well, and speaking of the standalone nature, I think we didn't watch very much of the dub of this, but we did kind of have snippets of it. And they seem to add a lot of exposition in the English dub, trying to kind of like fill the gaps. Because if you didn't know what was going on, like, we had to kind of fill the gaps for some of our friends as we were watching it, who've maybe heard us talk about the manga but haven't read it yet. And so there was a bit of us being like, that's not what that how that happened. And that character means way more. What's going on?
Oh. The second episode was very weird.
Yeah, because the first episode stuck pretty true to the manga with a few, you know, changes to make it make sense. But the second episode took what is kind of like the lead into the climactic battle kind of meshed it with this first plot, like early plot line in the manga where they're just kind of trying to hide under the radar while they're getting away from all of the armies initially. And then, yeah, it kind of combined what would have been the climactic battle, but that had not been released yet in the manga, so they couldn't complete it. They could kind of just get close and then kind of jump away.
Yeah, it definitely brought you right up to the climactic battle scene. And there was a moment where Ryu turns to Ashura and is like, hey, do you remember who I am? And in the comic, this is the point where Ashura stabs Ryu to death.
Yeah.
And the entire endgame starts. In this little episode, Ashura says, oh yeah, you're the creep who's always being mean to me. And you're like, oh my god, I like had a heart attack.
Yeah, and they, because the basic plot is, as in the manga, they decide, oh, we're missing the sixth star. Ashura is sensing something from Zenmi Castle, which is the castle where Teshakuten is. So let's go there, because we have no real choice. So they head there, and you kind of get shots of Kendappa and Tenno and Taishakuten and everybody else in the castle as they're sort of approaching, and, you know, they kind of end up sneaking in, basically, in very, like, loose disguise, I might add.
Yeah, Lucy referred to it as a Jedi disguise. Yeah. You just put on a poncho and you're like, done.
Yeah, no one will know. I'm great.
Yeah, it ends in a place that is really weird, too, because they leave. And they're like, oh, we know who the sixth star is. Now we're going to get ready to do the final battle.
Yeah, like, they get into the castle, and a lot of the things happen like you would kind of expect. Like, Ashura runs into his twin brother and sees his mother, and there's some weirdness. But instead of it triggering him to go dark Ashura and become a little demon of destruction or whatever, it kind of, like, leads to him just having this kind of, like, psychic connection with his dead father that kind of ends up being, like, hopeful and supportive, and then he and his friends are able to kind of like fight their way off and just leave. And in that moment, the sword reveals that Kendappa is the sixth star. So I assume for manga readers, that was a confirmation that we didn't know for sure, but everyone suspected. But they managed to do it without revealing her full nature. And so I kind of like that they left that in.
Yeah. And to avoid stargazing, I'm just going to say that this is a thing they have to do periodically with an animated version of something that comes out before the thing has ended,
mm-hmm.
where they need to come up with a resolution that won't reveal everything they have planned and ruin it for readers, but also isn't just false information that's going to ruin it for readers either.
Yeah.
That's so maddening to imagine having to write something that needs to have resolution and you know where your story's going.
Mm-hmm.
Nanase Okawa is very clear about how she always knows where a story is going to end.
Mm-hmm.
Whenever there's ambiguity in the writing, it's just ambiguity in how they're going to get there. And she always allows for things to change.
Mm-hmm.
As they're working, like, she'll let things change. But the endings, she always knows where she's going.
Mm-hmm. Well, and with the last volume, the last episode, we talked about how they'd planned out how many volumes there were going to be based on the lines of the prophecy, which they laid down in episode one. So, or volume one or whatever. And so they definitely have like a pretty stringent outline that I could see being flexible too, but they know where things are going.
Yeah. So it's really interesting to think about her writing this script, knowing what she wants to reveal and doesn't want to reveal, because it definitely tells you who the sixth star is. And yeah, if you were a reader, you probably, there's no way you didn't suspect, yeah, Kendappa. I mean, if anybody here was an old school reader who didn't suspect Kendappa, please tell me.
Yeah.
Because, like, we'll give you a star for that. Yeah. I don't know.
Appropriate.
Yeah. But we definitely did. I mean, I feel like the artwork, the promotional artwork and the covers to this book from the very beginning kind of told you who everyone was going to be.
Yeah, they were not really shy about depicting the stars. I think, to me, the most surprising thing was that Ashura counted. I had assumed until pretty much the end, and I thought my count was just off, that there was one more person I just didn't remember, and that Ashura wasn't standing in for one of the stars.
Yeah, but Ashura is one of the stars, and Kujaku is not one of the stars, but is mentioned in the prophecy elsewhere, yeah, which is interesting.
Yeah, so I suppose you could have thought he was going to be the sixth star for a bit there, or the fifth, depending on when you had the theory.
Yeah. But a very interesting thing for her to know how it was going to end, reveal just enough of the actual things that did happen, but then completely recontextualize all of that,
yeah,
for the reader in the actual finished version.
Mm-hmm. And you got to see a few shots of Taishakuten and Lord Ashura, you know, the senior or whatever, yeah, the former Lord Ashura.
Dead gay King Ashura.
Dead gay King Ashura. We don't know that he's gay, though. I think we had a whole point
about
how he's not.
Phrase. That's just a phrase in my household. Because we all feel dead and gay all the time, so I think we just say that. Like, that's normal. I'm sorry.
No, it's cool. With him, we had debates.
Yes,
and are still
true.
Having debates about how legitimate or completely creepy and kind of rapey that relationship, quote-unquote,
is. It was definitely rapey. Whether or not Ashura had any sort of okayness with it is up for debate.
Yeah, and he may have had other male folks that
yeah,
he,
we don't know.
Yeah, we don't know. We all know his preferences.
Clamp probably definitely know because, oh, boy, that's... that character is yeah. one of the characters who they wrote Dojinshi about, so they probably know.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm fine with not knowing.
Yeah, I would. Yeah, I don't think
it matters. I don't really want to pry too much into that sad man's yeah, life too much.
I hope he had some good times.
Yeah, that would be nice to think.
His wife was a little backstabby, so.
Yeah. I think his everyone was pretty backstabby.
Yeah.
Okay, let's see. A few other notes about this. The designs were interesting. They changed between the first episode and the second episode, which were made a year apart from mm-hmm. each other.
Yeah.
Again, by the same studio, but probably not by the same production staff.
Yeah, but they did some interesting, like, I can see art changing, but they changed, like, the colors of people's hair, which was a little interesting.
Yeah, in the first episode, Yul definitely has, like, bright red hair, and he usually has light brown hair and slightly darker skin mm-hmm. in their own artwork of him.
Yeah.
Let alone the one or two other times that they've showed up in animation.
Yeah.
Because they do show up in the Clamp and Wonderland animation, which is not stargazing. No. Which is telling you a basic fact about the universe. These characters do show up in that. And I think that the colors used in that little music video definitely are the colors I believe in for these characters.
Yeah, for any characters.
Yeah.
Like they, because that, we'll talk about that later, but yeah, I trust those colors.
We will do an entire episode on the Clamp and Wonderland music mm-hmm. videos because they're pretty significant and really sweet.
Mm-hmm. And very beloved to us.
Yeah, and honestly, and that episode is probably not that far in the future because mm-hmm. that's still probably, I think, 1994. Right now in our Clamp timeline, we are still in, technically, we are still in 1989, even though Rig Veda was written between 89 and 1996. That was 7 years to finish this, and this animation, as we said, came out in 1991 and then the second episode in 1992. It really never got any more animated adaptations. They didn't do, like, a big movie for this. There has never been a series. It would yeah. be interesting to see whether this ever does get revisited, but from interviews with Clamp, I think they don't want to.
Mm.
I think this took many, many years of their life and yeah. was a huge undertaking that they were really passionate about at first, and they saw it through to the end beautifully. The quality never leaves. It's exquisite. But I think that this was something that they knew, that they were learning how to make comics while they were working on it. This OAV is, I think, the first time Nanase Okawa wrote for TV or wrote for animation.
Yeah, it would make sense, yeah.
Yeah, and I actually think she did a pretty good job. There are some interesting places where the director or whoever was planning the animation itself from whatever script she wrote, there's a few places where they did cool things where they took elements that were mostly almost symbolic background stuff from the manga and actually brought it to life and, like, made it a little more centered and grounded, and that was really beautiful. Some of the designs and colors they picked are nuts to me. My least favorite was how Tennel, Ashura's twin brother, looks. My partner described him as looking like Burger King and Wendy's merged, and that was their mascot.
It really does, like, because he's got the like dark red Wendy's hair, but he's like wearing this very regal outfit.
It's really goofy.
I did find out the Clamp of Wonderland was 94, which is a little earlier than I thought, and interesting, because that will be, might be almost their, like, third animated short. I mean, we'll talk about it more, and I'll confirm that later, but yeah, so it was not too long after this, and while Rig Veda was still going.
Very, very interesting to think about how much they had accomplished already
mm-hmm.
by 1994.
Yeah, yeah.
They... 5 years after their debut, they had enough material to put together, like, this a self-indulgent music video where all their characters hang out together. They had enough published work, and they were famous enough that people wanted this.
Yeah, and we're going to talk a lot about that in our next episode, too, about kind of, like, how they were getting to that.
Yes. So the first time that I watched this, and I don't have strong memories about it, so this was probably something I had on but never really connected with. The first time I watched this, we rented it from a comic book store in our hometown of Eugene, Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
This comic book store is Emerald City Comics,
mm-hmm.
and at the time, they had an enormous anime rental section.
Yeah, I believe they still do, too. It's been a hot minute since I went home, at least since I went back to the comic book store anyway. But yeah, at the time, and it was still VHS, most of it when we were frequenting it.
This era, it would already been mostly DVDs by the time that we left for college.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, by then. But when I was most using it anyway, it was VHS.
And I feel like basically any anime VHS that existed, they probably had.
Mm-hmm.
Like any one that existed in the US with subtitles or dubbing.
Yeah.
They had. They would definitely have the dubbed version if that existed, which I couldn't handle and did not want to listen to. So I have seen a few things entirely dubbed because of them, but would often choose not to watch something if I thought it was going to be dubbed, because I just couldn't take it. I still can't quite take it.
See, I, though now, prefer subbed too. I mean, I preferred subbed at the time too, but I didn't really have that squeamishness for a long time, so I watched a lot of crap dubbed. Like, just because that was all there was. Because, again, VHS, you didn't have the language options that you did once DVDs came around. So if it was there and it was anime, I wanted to see it, so I watched it.
Some of that is probably because you're an only child and I have, like, a huge family and no privacy. So if they were saying embarrassing things, maybe sexy things, or maybe just embarrassing dumb garbage, which, let's face it, some things are embarrassing dumb garbage, especially badly translated, because nobody makes any sense and everything they're saying is really stilted and they can't deliver the like magic part of the story without sounding really stilted, because it's such a different cultural concept and it's not really coming from the heart for the voice actors in English, because they're like, I don't know what this is, but I'm going to deliver it with gusto.
And I have to do it in one take because we're on a deadline.
Yeah. And I think this has probably gotten better recently, but it was not better in 1997. Like, it was not very good. It was still an era where they probably had very few notes about what they were saying and why they were saying it. It was more important to match the mouth flap than to have it sound like a person talking.
Yeah, from the voice actors I've seen speak, not only was there not much time, there often wasn't even a script. Like, they didn't actually have a translation sometimes. They were just kind of like, I mean, they had a script by the time it got to them, but there was not like a consistent translated script for the people to go off of. They had just written something that kind of made sense based on the animation.
Oh yeah, that was an entire era of just completely making it up.
Yeah.
Luckily, I mean, this was never treated like that, but I think that just hearing, like, anyone in my family hearing some of this dialogue in English would kill me inside. That's so fair. That was a little bit of why I just couldn't handle it. Whereas with Japanese, I would be learning Japanese while I was listening, and I could pick up on things that I wasn't going to get in the translated version. Yeah. It would help me understand why a translator would choose to translate something that differently than I had seen it translated as before.
Yeah. And there's a lot, like, I don't know that it comes up very much anymore, but there's a bit of a debate, dub versus sub, because there's a lot of humor that doesn't translate unless you actually literally completely translate it to something else. So sometimes dub, I think, can get away with humor without someone not needing to know all the Japanese context. They can just do a similar joke in English that will actually come across as a joke, whereas if you're just reading the subtitles, you would need to have all this cultural context that you probably just don't have.
Yeah, but for those of us who might have it or want to have it, it's still there in the subtitled version, and I could potentially get the joke.
Mm-hmm.
With the dub one, I'm only ever going to laugh at a joke that was written third hand, and is, like, as much as there are so many talented people working really hard in all of those things, it's not the hand of the original writer, and I think that really bothers me.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it should or shouldn't, I'm definitely not telling anybody else it should bother them, but I know it bothers me, where I really want to know what they were originally trying to say. Also, a lot of characters are written for voice actors, for specific voice actors or voice acting types, and we don't have those same types of voice acting in English. We don't have character archetypes that are quite the same character archetypes, and we certainly don't have people training to sound exactly like them. And I think these days there's people who grew up watching anime who are now doing voice acting who maybe are trying to exemplify those types themselves. Yeah. But it always sounds a little different between English and Japanese because English wasn't structured to sound like this, which is great. It's fine. English sounds like English, and English voice acting for American cartoons can be really, really heart-wrenching and really good in ways that I just always find dubbing to be a little difficult. I find it difficult to get the same depth for those things because I think that you are having to tell someone to give a performance using language that is stilted and mushed in ways that is never how they would say them in their own lives. Mm-hmm. It's not how they would say these lines if they had the same content to get across. And I just think that makes it harder for people to give a performance that I am going to be really comfortable with.
Yeah. One thing I kind of miss that I just personally don't encounter very much is fan subs. Don't support the official release. Do it. Give money to the anime industry so that they will make us more good anime. But I liked how fan subs would really happily have the little asterisks and then an explanation at the top of the screen. So you could have those really insular cultural jokes and it wouldn't go over your head, or they wouldn't have to like try and fit the explanation or the context into the sentence. They would just have a little little footnote. So you could learn something about the culture and still, like, you could just pause and read the thing, or you could ignore it if you didn't want it. And I don't really see that in the professional translations.
Yeah, it pops up sometimes, and I know some people really hate it and find it really annoying, but for me, I'm never interested in trying to fit anime into an American context. Hmm. I feel like I should be trying to understand the original context. That if I'm going to look at the pop culture of another culture, that I'm the one who needs to change and learn. It should not be adapting massively to me. Mm-hmm. And that's just sort of how I view everything. Mm-hmm. If I'm watching movies from India, I don't want it to be rewritten for an American. I want somebody to give me some notes about what I'm missing, because that way I won't miss it the next time.
Yeah, like I want to use this as a way to learn about that other culture that I find interesting. And I have this access to it through this piece of pop culture, and I want to make use of that.
Yeah, if I'm reading French poetry, I don't speak French, but I would sure like some notes to help me understand why the original was so good, mm-hmm. when the translation is missing so much of what's beautiful about the original. Even if I can't experience it the way a native speaker would, that's fair. I can't. I'm not a native speaker yet, right? Yeah, I'm not a native speaker. I could eventually become fluent enough to get it.
Yeah.
But, like, I'm not a native speaker. I don't need to believe I'm a native speaker. I do feel like having respect for the fact that it was made for not me is good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I do think culturally we as Americans are a little more into that, or at least more accepting of that. It used to be a lot harder to sell something with subtitles, I think, back in, like, the 90s, and now people are much more okay with it.
Yeah, it's more common. I think that there's also a little bit of, like, there's an accessibility thing with subtitles also, where if you don't hear, subtitles are a necessity. Mm-hmm. And the more we normalize having subtitles for things in your native language, that's great.
Yeah, I'll often listen to American movies with subtitles on, or with a closed captioning on, because sometimes it's loud outside, or a truck goes by, or I couldn't understand what that person with an accent was saying because I haven't adjusted to their accent in my brain yet.
Yeah, there are people with auditory processing disorders, and subtitles can be really helpful. And yeah, they do visually distract, but so can anything. Mm-hmm. Like, anything can be visually distracting, from the other stuff in your room to something flickering on the screen, of fire in the background of the screen. I think there's no way to make anything perfect, because there is no perfect pure version of whatever. Mm-hmm. But for me, trying to get close to what the original was is the point. Mm-hmm. I don't feel like someone needs to remake that for me to make it better.
Mm-hmm. Well, and in this case, with the OVA, is just to pull us back around. Yeah. Listening to it in Japanese was useful, because we know enough Japanese that we could kind of get some of our questions answered. Like,
we know enough to be dangerous.
Yeah, to just be very wrong, I guess. But we were able to confirm that Ashita, they're not using gendered phrases or words to refer to Ashita, and Ashita themselves is not using, like, a specific gendered, like, word for I, like ore or watashi or something. Like, they're usually using their name, which is not that weird in Japanese. It would be very strange translated like that. But
especially for a cute kid, which Ashita is mostly a cute kid, like, it's sort of endearing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I mean, we knew that that character was gender neutral and treated that way by the comic. But in these subtitles, though, they used she, whereas the manga versions we both read used he, which, you know, further confirms it, but was kind of interesting.
Yeah, down to calling Ashura Princess Ashura in the dub.
Dub, not in the subtitle, but in some of the snippets of the dub that we heard, they were referring to them as Princess Ashura.
Which really goes hard in on the kind of, like the dub especially working to clean it up, which is weird, because they definitely downplayed everything between Soma and Kandapa.
Yeah, we got a
in
few.
Both versions,
yeah.
in the Japanese even, like, it's just sort of downplayed. There's almost no moment. Maybe they have, like, their glance at each other is slightly long, but the manga is so much more clear than that.
Yeah, you get, especially in that second episode, you maybe get, like, through the you know, sad looks or whatever, that they have a relationship of some kind, but not anything that would tell you it was romantic if you didn't know, you know. Probably just that, oh, maybe they know each other, maybe they're sisters, like, you know.
Yeah, it could have been anything. And I would say the same thing with Ashura Oh and Taishakuten, who have their climactic battle flashback, is how we opened the second episode. And maybe there's a glimpse of them being a little tender about it. Like, Ashura definitely says something we can't hear, and that is a classic, like, oh no, he's saying something. We know what he's saying. He's saying I love you or something like that. But that's not what he's saying in the manga, and it's really, really, any tension between them is really, really downplayed.
Yeah, and I mean, even in the manga, you get various, you know, flashbacks to that scene of them fighting. But in the manga, you, at least I felt like there was some sexual tension there. Like, there are a few scenes where they have that tenderness, the way they're like looking at each other, even as they're like stabbing each other or whatever. Like, there are a few little like visual hints, and I felt like just in the actual animation, those were not there.
Yeah.
And then the other scene that we noticed was in the first episode. It's kind of minor, but they're spending the night in one of this safe house type.
They're spending the night in some ruins.
Yeah. But I think it's one of those, like, this was a barricade or whatever, like
a fortress.
They're in minus two Earth or whatever.
Yeah.
And in the manga, like, Do sleeps off to the side because he makes a big deal about how Ashura, like, talks in their sleep and kicks or whatever. But I think Soma also sleeps somewhere else. But Yasha and Kotaku and Ashura kind of sleep in this little, like, adorable family bundle of, like, cute kid with, like, the limbs flailing. And,
yeah, sleeping between their parents.
Yeah. And so it very much has that slight implication that Yasha and Kotaku could be a couple. Like, that's not really, that doesn't come up very much at all, but it has that kind of, like,
yeah, there's a very, like, found family thing going on with Kotaku posed as the mother, and that just did not come through in the anime, where they sort of started that scene and then didn't end it the same way.
Yeah, like, Kotaku did sort of the same, like, emphasizing how much Yasha and Ashura are, like, a close little family, but didn't really insert himself into it, whereas in the manga, he's very much, like, playing along as the wife or something.
Yeah.
And that was just interesting, that was kind of, I mean, and they changed it in a way that kind of made sense. Yasha was, like, sitting up to keep watch or something.
Yeah, and we don't know whether she changed this because she didn't want to go there when there was no time to do a good job of it, or whether there was pressure being put on them to not really have that in there. Like, we don't know whether she was self-censoring or whether she was sort of censored. But it's interesting how much that is a central part of why you would read Rig Veda.
Yeah.
You're reading it for various kinds of tension, most of which is homoerotic rather than heteronormative.
Yeah, there aren't very many hetero couples.
Yeah, and most of the ones who exist are kind of already a thing.
Yeah, or it's, like, not a love thing. It's, like, they're married for the sake of making babies because that's how it works in old times.
Rig Veda is definitely not a manga celebrating heterosexual love.
Yeah.
It's definitely not.
Yeah.
And it's interesting how this didn't insert any of that. Like, the OAV did not insert anything to establish that in any way, but it was really missing that tension as well.
Yeah.
So, all in all, Lucy, how do you feel it held up?
I think it was good. I enjoyed it. I mean, it was nice to see our beloved characters jumping around. I wish that the like, art sensitivity and colors from the second episode had been for the first episode, too. Like, I don't think I'll ever forgive Taishakuten for that weird blonde hair he had.
Yeah, he definitely has light purple slash white hair. Like, yeah. He has to.
Yeah, I can't see him as, like, a blonde. It just made my brain hurt.
You tell me somebody is, like, a god king and then make him blonde and I'm gonna roll my eyes because he definitely should have white hair. I mean, come on, we know this.
Yeah, he's, like, the first creepy white hair in Clamp. We can't lose that, Robin.
Yes. No, that's gonna come up so much.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I think that they don't stand on their own at all.
Yeah, I don't think I would show this to someone I was trying to convince to read Rig Veda. Like, I just don't think that there would be any point. I think they'd just be confused.
Yeah, I mean, like, 25 years ago, we could watch this and be like, ooh, I think I might need to know more about Rig Veda.
That mysterious early Clamp work that will never come to America.
Yeah, like, back in that era. And, I mean, that's a thing to be said about Emerald City Comics.
Yeah, yeah. Our beloved comic book store had a really good selection of not only everything that came out, but kind of through people we knew there, we could get fan sub of stuff that we thought would never come out.
Yeah, which was the only, and you know, we didn't pay for this. It was
That was just like, you know,
it was friends. Like a secret club.
Yeah.
But also it was entirely something that existed because we did not think we were ever going to have access to it.
Yeah, there were things I got that I was told by the people who had them, like, yeah, here's all of Marmalade Boy, it'll never come to America. And I watched like 200 episodes of Marmalade Boy or whatever, assuming it would never come to America.
Yeah, and definitely as soon as things were licensed, they bought official versions of everything.
Oh, yeah.
Which is really nice. Like, yeah. It's nice to know that, like, yes, there's some of this stuff that was, like, iffy, but man, it was iffy to build community, and as soon as they didn't need to do that, they stopped doing that because they didn't need to do it.
Yeah.
But I was also going to say that, they had the Rig Veda OAVs and the Tokyo Babylon OAVs long before the manga for either one of those things was even, like, an option to buy. It was even being mentioned, particularly.
Yeah, because we didn't, those didn't come out into America until 03 or 04-ish.
Yeah.
And I definitely had watched these things before then.
Oh, yeah. And I think that's a really interesting way to look at this, where publishing took a long time to catch up to some of this stuff, but that's because these things weren't released in America as the harbinger of this series. Mm-hmm. It was released because it was just a cheap license that they could when they were just trying to dump something on us because there was a hungry, hungry home video market.
Yep.
So, delightful that that is, like, this was definitely an early thing that I watched. Like, this was an early anime for me and an early Clamp thing. But, oh my goodness, to try to go from this to that comic, yeah, like, I don't know that this would hold up well for someone who is really used to anime moving.
Yeah, the animation was not great.
Yeah, very, very little, very few frames and a lot of reused stuff. But the artwork is really lovely, and it looks so much more like their artwork than some of their later TV series would.
Yeah, especially that second episode had just a noticeable jump in, like, trying to really match their style.
I really enjoyed that.
Yeah, yeah. And the first episode wasn't bad either. It was a little bit more off-model, but I felt like they were both, like, a solid try. And yeah, I think more solid than some of the stuff you'll see later down the line.
The first episode had that really pretty, like, late 80s, early 90s OAV thing where, like, lots of very apparent lines in the hair.
Yeah.
Just a level of detail that you can't really do in TV animation. So it meant that the colors became a little more pastel so that you could see the line work. And I, have to admit, I really like that look. Even though even though the second episode was a little, like, more on model.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that pastel look also already kind of has more the look of, like, airbrush manga coloration.
And watercolors and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So it was a good watch.
Yeah.
It doesn't stand on its own, but I do think that if you can find this, if you can find it, like, at a...
Yeah, I got it on Amazon for, like, $5 used, so it's out there. The DVDs are around. I say if you like Rig Veda, the manga, and you want to see your characters animated, definitely, like, pick it up.
I kind of dig the soundtrack, which is, like, really minimalistic and weird, and it's sort of stuck in my head now, and it's also mostly
very,
just, like,
hair-bangy.
Yeah, well, it's more, like, kind of... It's, like, minimalistic industrial synthwave. And I like all of those words together, so if you do too, definitely check it out.
I meant headbanging, by the way.
Yeah, it's headbanging.
You bang your hair when you're banging your head, you know?
A little bit.
All right, we're going to do some housekeeping before we end here. We've started doing this fun thing where we're going to make themed drinks whenever we do one of these little discussions on a project. So this week, we did
I made a Rosewater Lassie themed milkshake.
And we're going to put a recipe and a picture of that up on our blog at clampcastinwonderland.com. And you can also follow us on Twitter at ClampcastPod and on our Facebook group, Clampcast in Wonderland. Next week, we're going to do a sweet little palette cleanse talking about Niju Menzo ni Onegai, or Man of Many Faces. It's a two-volume manga. It was released in America around 2003, so those volumes are out there. I was able to buy them at our local bookstore, Powell's, and I'm sure you can find them wherever you are.
You can order them from Powell's wherever you are,
yeah,
too,
probably. Yeah, do that.
Support indie bookstores.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks for coming with us on our journey through Clamp's Wonderland.
Until next time, remember that everything will be all right.
And try not to lose an eye.